11th of February, 1919. If we recall the keynote of the public lectures, we shall see that the essential thing in our present time is to strive for a kind of structural classification within the social organism. I always say strive for there is no question of wanting to effect a revolutionary change overnight. What we must strive towards is to distinguish between the things that have been affected by the modern trend to centralize. Instead of the unitary state, we must work towards having an independent sphere of the social organism, embracing all that has to do with spiritual and cultural life, and existing autonomously alongside the other spheres of society. This sphere will include education, instruction, art, literature, and also, as I have mentioned already and shall touch on in the public lecture tomorrow, everything concerned with the administration of civil and criminal law. A second sphere of the social organism will, strictly speaking, be what we have been calling the state, and which in modern times people have been loading up with all manner of things, such as state schools, for example. This has been the general tendency over the past 400 years. And today, due to the influence of socialist and social ideas, people want to take the life of the economy and weld it into a unity with what is par excellence the political sphere. These two spheres must work their way apart again. We should have, independent of one another, a political state as the second sphere of the social organism, and everything that includes the circulation of commodities, the life of the economy, should form a relatively independent third sphere. Let us now look at this matter from an aspect not so easily accessible to people who are not within our movement. And let us pursue this to a kind of culmination so that a deeper understanding of today's human situation may arise out of it. Take a look at what, from our earthly point of view, we call our spiritual life, our intellectual life, our life of culture. This covers everything which, in one way or another, lifts us out of our solitary egoism and brings us together with other people to form groups. Let us take what, for the majority of people, is still the most important manifestation of spiritual cultural life, namely, the particular aspect of it which should bring us into a relation with supersensible spiritual life. I mean the practice of religion, which takes place in the various religious communities. It is people's soul needs which cause them to seek each other out, and it is these similar soul needs which unite them. Education, too, means that one person cares for another in the realm of the inner life. When I read a book, I am also drawn out of my individual egotistic self, for I am not the only person receiving the thoughts of the author. Even if the book is read only by some people and not by everybody, I am absorbing the same thoughts as a number of other people, which means I have become a part of a company of readers who share the same soul content. It is an important characteristic of the life of the mind that this part of our life arises in freedom, out of the individual resolve of each single person. Yet it draws people together and forms communities out of what they have in common. For everyone looking for a deeper understanding, this last statement will indicate a connection between any kind of community of this kind and the central happening of the whole of Earth evolution, the mystery of Golgotha. For since the mystery of Golgotha, everything concerned with human fellowship belongs, in a sense, to the Christ impulse. This is the essential thing, that the Christ impulse does not belong to people singly, but when they are together. According to Christ Jesus' way of thinking, it is a great mistake to suppose that the solitary individual can establish a direct relation to him. The fundamental thing is that Christ lived, died, and rose from the dead for humanity, for what humankind signifies as a whole. Therefore, since the mystery of Golgotha, the Christ event is immediately involved, and we shall return to this point, when any kind of human fellowship develops. Accordingly, anyone who really understands the world will realize that even though earthly spiritual life springs from the most individual source, from personal aptitudes and talents, it becomes involved with the Christ event. Let us now look, first of all, at this earthly spiritual cultural life by itself, that is, at religion, education, art, and so on. These activities draw us into relationships with other people. Here we have to distinguish between those things which draw us into connections with other people through our actual destiny, karma, and those which, strictly speaking, are not connected with our own individual karma. We have various relationships with people who come into our lives. We form new relationships with particular people. Some of the connections we establish are nothing else than the effects of relationships formed in earlier lives. Others will have karmic consequences in future lives. There are a great number of different kinds of relationship between individual human beings. The connections directly related to our karma must be distinguished from the wider connections that arise when we come together with people because we belong to the same religious community, have the same education, are both reading the same book, or sharing the same artistic activity, and so on. The people we meet in these ways are not always related to us karmically from an earlier life. Certainly, there are communities which point to a common destiny in earlier lives. But with regard to these large communities I have been speaking about, it is usually not so. They point to something else. We are referred to the end of the period we spent in the supersensible world between death and a new birth, the time when we are approaching our next incarnation. Being mature enough now, we take up spiritual connections with the hierarchies of the angels, the archangels, and the archai. Spiritual connections with the hierarchies together. And further, in the spiritual supersensible world before our birth, we also come close to other human souls due to be incarnated later than ourselves, who for various reasons have to wait longer for their incarnations. According to our level of maturity before birth, we go through a whole range of supersensible experiences before we are drawn again into earthly life through birth. And the forces we receive at this point guide us to the very place on earth which will enable us to experience those communities of earthly spiritual life I have been speaking about. What we should focus on here is that our earthly spiritual life, all that we experience by being religious people, through being brought up and educated, through absorbing artistic impressions, and so on, is not determined solely by earthly circumstances, but by the experiences we have had in supersensible realms before we came down through birth into this earthly spiritual life. Just as an image in a mirror indicates what is being reflected, So, does earthly spiritual cultural life give an indication of what the human being experienced before entering the physical body? In this regard, there is, on Earth, nothing that has such a real, living, and close relationship to the supersensible world as this earthly spiritual life, which, while it shows many irregularities, even these irregularities have a meaningful connection with what we experience, in a quite different way, of course, in the supersensible realm. The fact of our earthly spiritual life being connected with pre-earthly life gives it a special position in life. Nothing else in earthly life is so closely connected with our life before birth as the sphere of our spiritual cultural life on Earth. A spiritual investigator has to draw special attention to this. He separates earthly spiritual life from the other human activities we are subject to here on Earth, because supersensible observation shows him that this earthly spiritual life has its roots and its driving force in the life before birth. For the spiritual investigator, this is what distinguishes earthly spiritual cultural life from other human activities. It is different with what can strictly be called political life, the life of civic rights, the part of life regulated by the state. However hard one may try, with the most exact methods of spiritual science, to discover what this actual life of the state, political rights, civic rights, is connected with, one finds no connection at all between this sphere and a supersensible element. This sphere belongs totally to the earth. We must try and understand exactly what is meant by this. For instance, what is a good example of a down-to-earth political constitutional matter? Ownership of property. If I am the owner of a plot of land, this is solely due to the fact that I have been given the exclusive right on a political basis to use this land and can exclude everyone else from doing so. The same applies to everything based on common law. Strictly speaking, the life of the state is the sum total of common law, together with the sum total of everything that affords society a certain outer protection. This is earth life proper, and it has to do solely with the needs and drives we have between birth and death. However much the state may sometimes imagine that it is God-given, according to the deeper meaning of all religious creeds, the following applies. In the first place, we have what Christ Jesus told the people in the language of that period: give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Faced with the pretensions of the Roman Empire, he wanted above all to separate everything to do with political life from all that is an image of supersensible life. But every attempt on the part of the purely earthly sphere of the state to introduce a supersensible element into it, when, for example, the state makes itself virtually responsible for religious life or education, and nobody nowadays doubts that this should be so, then people of a deeper religious nature described this by saying, whenever an attempt is made to lump together things of a spiritual, supersensible nature with the externalities of the sphere of the state, then the rulership is in the hands of the unlawful prince of this world. You may realize that however much we ought to cogitate about what the unlawful prince of this world means, we do not get anywhere. Only through spiritual science can you find its meaning. The unlawful prince of this world rules whenever an authority which should be concerned only with the ordering of earthly affairs claims the right not only to govern spiritual cultural life, but, as we shall see later, economic life as well. The lawful prince of this world is at work when the realm of the state includes only those things which arise solely on the basis of those forces that appertain to human life between birth and death. So we have reached a spiritual scientific understanding of the second branch of the social organism. It is the realm oriented towards the needs and drives of human beings between birth and death. We now come to the third branch of society, to the kind of connections existing in the economic sphere. Just think for a moment of the kind of relation we have to the world through the economic sphere. You will easily understand what this relation is if you make yourselves imagine the possibility of our becoming totally submerged in purely external economic life. If that were to happen, what should we be like? We should be nothing else but thinking animals. What prevents us from this is that apart from economic life, we have a life of rights, a political life, a sphere of the state, and a knowledge of the spirit, an earthly spiritual cultural life. Economic life pushes us more or less down onto a subhuman level. But precisely through being pushed down into the subhuman, we can, at this level, cultivate interests that are fraternal, in the true sense of the word. In no other realm than that of economic life is it possible for us to develop so easily and naturally human relationships that are brotherly, in the full sense of the word. Where our spiritual cultural life is concerned, what is the dominating impulse? Fundamentally, it is a personal interest, which, although it is on a soul level, is egotistic. What people want from religion is that it saves their souls. They want education to develop their talents. And they want either to enjoy what they choose to indulge in by way of artistic presentations, or to gain an increase of life forces. It is always the case that what leads a person to the life of the spirits of the spiritual sphere is egoism of a grosser or more refined sort. This is perfectly understandable. On the other hand, in the life of rights, the political life, we have to do with what makes us equal before the law. We have to do with how one person relates to another. Concern for our rights belongs here. Among animals, there are no rights. In this respect, also, we are even in earthly life raised above the animals. However, both in the connections between people as members of a religious or educational setting, or as citizens of the state, we recognize the existence of personal claims and wishes. In the economic sphere, something can come about, especially when we overcome ourselves, which is not derived from personal desires. Namely, brotherhood, consideration for other people, living a life that is an example to others. In the spiritual cultural sphere, we receive what we choose to receive. In the rights sphere, we lay claim to things we cannot do without if we want to make sure of a life that is worthy of a human being as an equal among equals. And in the economic sphere, something is born which unites people in their feeling life, namely brotherliness. This brotherliness comes about through the connections arising when, for example, we form a relationship on the basis of what each of us possesses, on the basis of what each of us needs, and what each of us has. If we persevere with cultivating brotherliness in the sphere of economics, then something emerges from this sphere. This brotherly relationship among people is an essential component of the economic realm if this is to become healthy and sound. And if we cultivate it, it becomes an imponderable that we take with us through the gate of death into the supersensible life after death. On Earth, economic life appears to be the lowest of the three spheres. Yet precisely from this sphere, an impetus arises, which works on into the super-earthly realm after death. This is how the third branch of the social organism presents itself in the light of spiritual science. In a sense, it drives us into regions below the human level. Yet, in fact, this is a blessing, for from the brotherliness of economic life, we carry through the gate of death something which remains with us when we enter the supersensible world. Just as earthly spiritual cultural life points back like a mirrored image to supersensible spiritual life before birth, economic life, with all the influence it has on people, a social interest, a feeling for human community, brotherliness, points forward to supersensible life after death. Thus, we have distinguished the three social spheres in the light of spiritual science. Spiritual cultural life, pointing back to supersensible life before birth. Political life, as such, bound up with the influences affecting us between birth and death. And economic life proper, pointing forward to what we shall experience when we shall have passed through the gate of death. Just as it is true that as human beings we are at one and the same time earthly and super-earthly beings, bearing within us the fruits of what we have already lived through in the supersensible realm before birth, and developing within us the seeds of the experiences we shall have in the life after death. Just as besides these two mirrorings of supersensible life, we have an area of our life between birth and death that is particularly of the earth. And just as true as it is that our human life has three parts in it, so must the social organism around us be made up of three parts, if it is to serve as a foundation for human soul life as a whole. Therefore, for those who, through spiritual science, recognize man's place in the cosmos, there are much deeper reasons for understanding that a social organism must have a threefold structure, and that if everything is centralized, if everything is piled on to a chaotically jumbled social arrangement, then human beings are bound to degenerate, as in some respects they have in recent times, which has led to the terrible catastrophe of the First World War. When human beings shall gradually acquire, through working with spiritual science, what this is an awareness that every human relationship is inwardly related to the whole of humanity and to the wider world. This is, at the same time, the proper way to understand the Christ in our time and in the immediate future. This is the insight we shall receive if we are willing today to listen to the Christ. As I have often stressed, he himself told us, "I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." This means that what he has to say to us is not restricted to his days on earth, but he continues to speak to us, and we must continue to listen to him. We should not want only to read the Gospels, though certainly we should want to read them over and over again, but we should listen to the living revelation that springs from his continued presence among us. In the present age, his message is to change our way of thinking. As his forerunner, John the Baptist, said, "Renew your thinking so that it will open your eyes to the perception of your threefold human nature," which requires that the social environment you live on earth shall also have a threefold form. We are absolutely right in saying the Christ died and rose again for the whole of humankind. The mystery of Golgotha is an event that took place for us all. We become aware of this particularly at the present time, where nation rises up against nation in brutal war, and where, yet again, when events have come to a crisis, most people show a frenzy of wild rejoicing instead of reflectiveness and an awareness of our common humanity. Do not miss this point. All that we have experienced in the past 4.5 years of war, what we are experiencing now and will still have to experience, shows anyone who looks deeply enough that humanity has reached a kind of crisis with regard to a consciousness of the Christ. And this has happened because a true spirit of fellowship, a proper relationship between people, has been lost. It is an absolute necessity that people ask themselves, what is the right way to set about finding the Christ impulse again? A simple fact will show us that the way is not always to be found. Before the Christ had brought his impulse into earth evolution through the mystery of Golgotha, the people among whom Jesus Christ was born considered themselves to be the chosen people. And they believed that the world would be happy only if all the other peoples were to die off and their own stock to spread over the entire face of the earth. In a certain sense, that was a well-founded belief, for the God Jehovah had chosen this nation as his people, and Jehovah was regarded as the one and only God. Prior to the mystery of Golgotha, the ancient Hebrew people were justified in having this view, because they were the very nation through whom the Christ would come. But when the mystery of Golgotha had occurred on earth, this way of thinking should have come to an end. After that, it was obsolete. The recognition of Jehovah should have been replaced by the Christian way of speaking of individual human beings, in the manner Jehovah's people spoke of all the members of one particular nation. Today, however, we are experiencing a great many relapses. What is it other than backsliding when every nation, though it may regard this differently and call it by another name, wants to worship a kind of Jehovah, a special national god of its own? Certainly, people do not speak in the kind of religious formulae they once used, but with a modern way of thinking. They have now become accustomed to using another word for this, although I would have thought the expression way of thinking was a good description. To be better understood, we could also make the concession of doing what they do and using the word mentality in public instead of the expression way of thinking, which I have always used. So, today's mentality leads to each nation wanting to install its own particular national god and to confine itself within a strictly national existence. The inevitable result is that nation rages against nation. We are experiencing a relapse into the old Jehovah religion, with the difference that the Jehovah religion is falling apart into a multiplicity of Jehovah religions. Today, we are really confronted with an atavistic reversion to the Old Testament. Over the whole earth, humanity is bent on dividing itself into separate sections, contrary to the spirit of Christ, who gave himself, his life, and his being for humankind as a whole. Human beings are trying to organize themselves as though they had national gods, as though Jehovah still ruled over them. This was justified before the mystery of Golgotha, but now it is a retrograde step. We must see that this, in its proper light, This is the way of nationalism. And nowadays, it is a relapse into the Old Testament. This reversion, which will present modern mankind with terrible trials, has only one remedy: to draw near to the Christ again on a spiritual path. For those concerned with spiritual science, a very deep question is, what is the right way at this special time to find Christ Jesus out of the depths of our own hearts in the way our souls are constituted today? I have often spoken about this subject in this group from other points of view, and you can see what a serious question it is from the fact that many official exponents of Christianity have actually lost the Christ. There are plenty of well-known parsons, pastors, etc., who talk about the Christ. The essence of what they say is that a human being can form a relation to the Christ through a certain deepening of the inner life, a certain inner experience. But if you follow up what these people mean by the Christ, you will find that no distinction is made between this image of Christ and God in general, the Father God, in the sense of the Gospels. You will agree that Harnack, Adolf Harnack, for example, is a celebrated theologian who, in Switzerland, is emulated by many people, and who has even had a booklet published on the nature of Christianity. He says a great deal about the Christ, but what is there to convince us that what he says applies to the Christ? Nothing at all, for what he says could just as well apply to Jehovah. So the whole book on the nature of Christianity is in reality untrue. It would become true only if it applied to the ancient Hebrew world and were translated so that every time the word Christ appears in it, Jehovah were put in its place. I am telling you the truth, but people of today hardly have the faintest idea of what I am talking about. From countless pulpits all over the world, preachers speak about the Christ, and because people hear the word Christ, they believe the preachers actually mean Christ. They never stop to think that what the preachers are saying will be right only if the word Jehovah is substituted for Christ. You know, the most harmful things happening in our time are caused by a certain kind of untruthfulness. Do not imagine I am saying this with the intention of offending or blaming anyone. Not at all. I only want to state a fact. Those people who are often in the throes of genuine untruth, in fact, of actually telling lies, are ignorant of it and have thoroughly good intentions in their own way. It is hard today for humanity to arrive at the truth, because what I have called a real untruth has an exceptionally strong backing of tradition. And this intrinsic untruthfulness, which rules the day to an immense extent, breeds that other untruthfulness which has today taken hold in all sorts of aspects of life, so that people even begin to ask, is anything true anymore? Is there any truth left? Therefore, in those who are striving on the path of spiritual science, the serious question arises, how shall I find the true way to the Christ, to the particular divine being whom we are justified in calling the Christ? If all that happens is that we are born and from birth to death live on earth with the sort of soul condition that arises when we grow up and develop in a thoroughly conventional way, there will be no motivation to come to the Christ. It does not matter how much spiritual activity goes on in us, we shall not feel it necessary to turn to the Christ. If without doing a certain thing, which I shall tell you about in a moment, we simply lead the sort of life most people do today, we shall have no relation to the Christ. So how do we form a connection to him? The initiative to follow the path to Christ, even if this sometimes arises from the dim realm of the subconscious, must come from ourselves. To connect with the kind of divinity we have identified in Jehovah, we simply have to be normally healthy. Not to find even Jehovah is really to be ill in some way. To be an atheist means to have a kind of illness. If you have developed normally, in a thoroughly healthy way, you will not be an atheist, because it is ridiculous to believe that the healthy human organism could possibly not have a divine origin. A feeling for ex Deo nascimur is something that a healthy human being takes for granted in the course of social life. If he does not recognize, I am born out of the divine, then he must have some defect that comes to expression in his becoming an atheist. This recognition, however, brings us to a generalized conception of the divine, which is not the Christ. Although modern pastors, through an intrinsic lie, call this the Christ. We shall only reach the Christ, I am referring here to the immediate present, if we recognize something beyond a natural state of normal health. For we know that the mystery of Golgotha was enacted on earth, because without it, people would not have been able to maintain a condition worthy of human beings without finding the Christ impulse. So we must not only establish our humanity during our lifetime, but must establish it anew if we are to be Christians in the true sense and draw near to the Christ. We must rediscover our humanity in the following way. We must strive for mental honesty. Pluck up the courage to be able to admit in utter sincerity that since the mystery of Golgotha, we are not born free from prejudice where our world of thought is concerned. We are all born with certain prejudices. As soon as we regard the human being as perfect from the outset, after the manner of Rousseau, or in any other way, we shall not find the Christ at all. This is possible only if we recognize that a human being living after the mystery of Golgotha has a defect for which he has to compensate through his own activity in this life. I am born as a prejudiced person, and freedom from prejudice in my thinking is something I have to achieve in the course of life. And how can I achieve it? The one and only way is that instead of taking an interest only in what I myself think and in what I consider right, I must develop a selfless interest in every opinion I encounter, however wrong I consider it to be. The more a person prides himself on his own inflexible opinions and is interested only in these, the further he distances himself at this moment in world evolution from the Christ. The more he develops a social interest in other people's opinions, even though he considers them mistaken, the more he lets these opinions shed light on his own thoughts, the more he is able to look at other people's thoughts, which interest him, although he thinks they are mistaken, and gives them the same respect he gives to his own thoughts, which he probably considers to be true, the greater the feeling he will have in his innermost soul for words which Christ spoke, and which have to be interpreted today according to the new language of Christ. He said, Inasmuch as you have done it unto one of these, the least of my brethren, so have ye also done it unto me. The Christ will not stop revealing himself to human beings to the end of earthly time. And this is what he is saying today to those people willing to hear him. In whatever the least of your brethren thinks, you must recognize that I am thinking in him and that I am feeling with both of you when you bring the other's thoughts into relation to your own and take a social interest in what is taking place in the other person's soul. Whatever you find when you discover the opinion or world outlook of one of the least of your brethren, you are seeking me. This is how the Christ is speaking to our life of thought today. For since the beginning of the 20th century, he has been revealing himself to human beings in a new way, not by inspiring us to speak in the way Adolf Harnack does of the God who may equally well be Jehovah, and in fact is, but by inspiring us to know that Christ is the God of all and every human being. But we shall not find him if we remain egotistically within ourselves, content with our own thoughts. We shall find him only by testing our thoughts against other people's, by extending our interest through a genuine tolerance for every part of human nature, and telling ourselves, I am born a prejudiced person, but if I am reborn from out of everyone else's thoughts with a comprehensive social feeling in my own thoughts, I shall find the Christ within me. I shall find the Christ impulse within me. If I stop thinking that I myself am the sole source of everything I think, but recognize myself right into my innermost soul as a part of humanity, then I have found one of the paths to the Christ. This is the path which today must be called the way to the Christ through thinking. It must become a serious part of our lives to educate ourselves to acquire a sense for considering other people's thoughts and to correct bias in ourselves through conversations with others. For if this were not to become a serious part of our lives, human beings would lose the way to the Christ. This is today's way, through thinking. The other path is by way of the will. Here, too, people are, to a large extent, well set on the path leading away from the Christ, not towards him. And in this realm, too, we must find the way to Christ. Young people still have some inborn idealism, but today's adults are apathetic and matter-of-fact. They are proud of their pragmatism and like to think they are being practical, though it points to a kind of limitation. Present-day humanity has no use for ideals drawn from spiritual sources. Young people still have these ideals. Never was the life of older people so markedly different from the life of the young as it is today. Lack of understanding among people is the chief characteristic of our time. Yesterday I alluded to the deep gulf which exists between the people of the working and the middle classes. Old and young people, too, how little they understand each other today. This is something we ought to take very seriously indeed. Let us try to understand the idealism of the young. Fine, but efforts are being made nowadays to drive it out of them. The aim is to deprive them of fairy tales and legends and of every kind of education which goes beyond bare external sense perception and exercises the imagination. Yet it will be no easy matter to drive all the natural youthful enthusiasm out of young people. But what actually is it? It is a fine thing, this youthful enthusiasm, a magnificent thing. But it ought not to be sufficient in itself. For after all, it is solely the idealism of ex Deo Nasimur, that aspect of the divine world which is identical with Jehovah. And since the mystery of Golgotha was enacted on earth, this must not be the only thing we have. There must be something else besides, a kind of idealism which one has to work for. Besides the inborn idealism of youth, we must see to it that we work in our human communities to acquire the kind of idealism that does not spring merely from the blood and youthful enthusiasm, but is acquired out of our own initiative. This sort of idealism, especially if one has worked for it through self-education, and it therefore cannot fade away with the passing of youth, is something which opens the way to the Christ, because again, it is something acquired during life between birth and death. Feel what a difference there is between instinctive idealism and the kind you have worked to acquire. If you can feel the tremendous difference between youthful enthusiasm and the kind which springs from taking hold of the life of the Spirit and which can be rekindled afresh again and again because we have made it part of our soul, independently of our bodily existence, then you will have reached the second idealism, the idealism of rebirth, and not the one implanted in us by nature. This is the path to the Christ, through the will. The other path is through thinking. Do not ask today for abstract ways to the Christ. Ask for these real ways. Inquire into the path of thought, which consists in acquiring tolerance of mind for the opinions of mankind in general, and developing a social interest in the thoughts of others. If you inquire into the path of the will, you will not hear of something abstract, but of the need to educate yourself in idealism. And if you cultivate this idealism, or, which is particularly necessary, you introduce it into the education of growing children, a sense will awaken for acting out of the Spirit, out of this idealism. Impulses will come to do more than one is pushed into doing from outside. When our actions spring from this self-taught idealism, we are realizing the intentions of Christ, who did not descend from realms beyond the earth in order to achieve merely earthly ends, but came down to earth from higher realms to fulfill a heavenly purpose. We shall only begin to unite with him if we develop idealism in ourselves so that Christ, who represents heaven on earth, can work in us. The words Paul said about the Christ, "not I, but the Christ in me," can only be realized by way of self-acquired idealism. Those who refuse to develop this idealism through a rebirth of their moral nature have no choice but to say, "not I, but Jehovah in me." But those who acquire the kind which has to be worked for can say, "not I, but the Christ in me." These are the two ways through which we can find the Christ. If we pursue them, we shall no longer speak the kind of language that is an inherent lie. Then we shall speak of the Christ as the God of our inner rebirth, while Jehovah is the God of our birth. People today must discover this distinction, for it is this alone which will enable us to have genuine social feelings and open our eyes to real social concerns. Whoever develops active idealism will also have love for humankind. You may preach as many sermons as you like, telling people they ought to love one another, but it is as if you were to preach to a stove. However much you coax it, it will not warm the room. But if you put coal into it, it will. And you will not need to go on telling it that its duty is to warm the room. You can preach to people forever about love, 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 but that is just empty talk. Make it your aim that people experience a rebirth of idealism, that besides instinctive idealism, they have an idealism which they have actively worked for and which lasts for life. Then you will set human love alight in people's souls. For to the extent that you develop idealism within yourself, you will get beyond egoism to a self-supporting concern for others. If you follow this twofold path, the way through thinking and the way through the will that I have described to you with regard to the renewal of Christianity, there is one thing you will certainly experience. Out of a thinking which is intrinsically tolerant and interested in the thoughts of others, and out of a will reborn through acquiring idealism, something arises that cannot be called anything else but a heightened feeling of responsibility for everything you do. If you want to see what is changing in your soul, then you will feel, as you progress on these two paths, as distinct from a conventional life in which these paths are not followed, you will feel the subtle changes taking place within yourself as your inner feeling of responsibility increases towards everything you think and do. This sense of responsibility will impel you to say, "Can I justify what I am doing or thinking?" Not merely with reference to my immediate circumstances and environment, but in light of my responsibility towards the supersensible spiritual world, can I justify it? Now that I know that everything I do here on earth will be inscribed in an Akashic record of everlasting significance, whose influence will work on and on. Oh, it makes a tremendously strong impression on one, this supersensible responsibility towards all things. If one is on the twofold path to the Christ, this feeling of responsibility works like a constant reminder, as though a being stood behind one, looking over one's shoulder, telling one all the time, "You are not responsible only in the eyes of the world. You are also responsible to divine, spiritual realms for all that you think and do." But this being who looks over your shoulder, heightening and clarifying our sense of responsibility and setting us on quite a different path than before, is the very one who unfailingly brings us close to the Christ who went through the mystery of Golgotha. This is what I wanted to speak about today, this path to the Christ, how it may be found, and how it manifests in the being I have just described. For this path to Christ has the closest connection with the deepest social impulses and tasks of our time.